Money Radio, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us. It is a pleasure to welcome Megan McArdle. She is an author and a blogger, and she has been writing for some of the top publications across the country, The Atlantic, The Economist, Newsweek. She's appeared on MSNBC, Fox News, and NPR. She is the author of a new book, The Upside of Down. The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. And that may sound like an interesting book for what we do, but there's really quite a bit of economics in it, and I was initially drawn to it because as a bit of a news junkie, I wander around to different sites, read a tremendous amount, and one of those writers that I always enjoy reading is Megan McArdle. She's carried the work from the publications to her new book, The Upside of Down. Megan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The idea behind the book, first of all, the idea that you would be writing about failure, because that's really what you're writing about.
Yes.
And sometimes when we write or focus on something, that's what we gravitate toward. Were you trying to fail with the book?
No, although I did say, you know, if the book failed, it would be just a stunning vindication. So I would really just be doing more research. You know, the reason that I decided to write it was that I had so much failure in my own life, and that after I got through those periods, what I realized was that they were setting the table for the things that came after, and that if it hadn't been for my failures, I wouldn't have been able to manage my successes. And so I decided, you know, you hear this over and over from entrepreneurs, from people in your personal life, and I decided, you know, someone needs to write a book making that point, that failure is often pre-success, especially if we handle it right.
We can't avoid failure. If everyone is honest, there have been failures in everyone's lives. There's no one who's perfect.
Indeed. This is the thing that it's really hard for people to grasp, is that it doesn't really matter what successful person you pick. Whoever they are, you are going to find some really spectacular failures in their life, from, you know, Winston Churchill, who so successfully led Britain through World War II, and also before that had been a really made disastrous mistakes as the Chancellor of the Exchequer in terms of currency valuation that drove their economy into a terrible recession. Mark Twain, a great writer who had about 97 jobs before he settled on writing. Colonel Sanders, who founded Kentucky Fried Chicken because his previous restaurant had failed. These are things that you see over and over again, but usually that story doesn't get told. The story that we tell ourselves about entrepreneurs and successful people is that they were people with high destinies who knew it from their moment of birth and were headed towards this fantastic outcome because of their sterling inner qualities. And to some extent, that's true, is that people who are resilient do tend to do better. They do tend to be more successful. And some of that is that we're, you know, some people are gifted with more optimism and more resilience to failure. However, that can be learned. And people who taught it to themselves in their worst times are often the people who come out later with stunning successes that neither they nor anyone else really predicted.
And yet we don't strive for failure. No one wants to apply to the school of hard knocks. That just makes sense. And so many times we try to insulate ourselves or isolate ourselves from failure. How are we faring at that aspect?
Well, I mean, this is a huge problem. Failure feels bad, right? It has to feel bad, because if it didn't feel bad, you wouldn't stop doing the things that don't work. And that's basically what failure is. It is nature's way of saying, hey, that doesn't work, stop. But because it feels bad, obviously we try to avoid it. And not to avoid it by getting out of it, by figuring out a way to fix where we've gone wrong, but instead by trying to engineer it out of our lives entirely. And the problem with that is that it's just not possible. You know, I love those movies where someone says, failure is not an option, but like, failure is always an option. And if you forget that it's an option, if you don't prepare for failure, if you don't understand that taking risks is a normal part of life, you're actually setting yourself up for bigger disasters. And I think you see that nowhere so clearly as the financial crisis, where everyone from homeowners to bankers to regulators thought that they had found, they'd managed to engineer risk out of the system, and they had this guarantee that everything was going to go fine. And that was, of course, when the market was getting ready to whack us with the biggest financial crisis, precisely because we were taking stupid risks and weren't prepared to fail.
Okay, so if we're taking stupid risk, that almost means that we are inevitably going to fail. So it makes sense that we shouldn't be taking stupid risk, right?
Yes. You know, one of the things that I try to emphasize in the book is that it's not possible to know what a smart risk is. We think it is that, you know, oh, I would have understood that this product wouldn't have worked out or whatever. But if you look at things like FedEx, for example, you know, the guy who founded FedEx was a business school student, and he submitted this plan to use excess capacity on passenger airliners for a class project. And all of the smart experts said, that's stupid, it'll never work. And you see that pattern again, over and over again. There's one great quote to the effect that basically all human progress can be described by finding the things that experts said were impossible right before they happened. And, you know, there's a threshold. You know, don't open a chain of restaurants selling meat-flavored ice cream is probably a good rule. But beyond that pretty basic threshold of not trying to sell people, say, a service where I come up and punch you in the face, it's actually really hard to tell what's going to succeed. We think it's easy because we have the benefit of hindsight, and that blinds us to the fact that there were many similar ideas and plans that just didn't work out because there was no way to find out whether it worked without trying. There is no way with a new product or a new movie or a new book to know whether people are going to like it until you put it out there. And unfortunately, you know, a realistic model of the universe is the universe. Anything smaller than that, you have to start making simplifying assumptions, and then there's always the chance that there's just something you didn't think of.
This process, and there is an economic process that describes this failure, is known as creative destruction.
Yes.
And it is from the economist James Schumpeter. But that is supposed to create value in the process. We come up with new and better values to replace the old values that have failed. That doesn't always seem to be the case, though. And sometimes we destroy value along the way.
That's totally true. I mean, there are companies that could have been saved but weren't for one reason or another. But what's actually amazing about the system of creative destruction is how well it works. If you think about the fact that, with the exception of some people during the Great Depression, for the past 250 years, every generation has lived better than the generation before. They have had longer lives. They have been healthier. They have been less worried about starving or freezing to death. I mean, these are things, you know, we romanticize the past, and there were genuinely nice things about living in the English countryside in 1700. But we forget that people died young, they didn't have enough to eat, they didn't have enough clothes, that each generation has gotten more of that, more autonomy, more opportunities to, you know, for entertainment. And so, you know, 250 years of that, this system has destroyed individual companies, destroyed individual products, but it has made all of us collectively immensely richer and healthier and happier.
Why do some things fail badly and others fail well?
That's a really good question, and that's really the core of the book, right, is what do you do after you failed? How do you make it a good failure rather than something that's crippling? And I'm going to give you the guidelines. They're going to sound obvious, but the fact is that most people don't do them. And so, you know, it's true of a lot of good advice, right? We know what it is. We just don't take it. But the first thing is that you have to understand that failure is possible. You know, good failure, hopefully, the best failure anyway, starts even before it happens by understanding that in any enterprise, there is risk, and that therefore you should prepare for some downside risk. So the example I give is that when my husband and I bought a house, you know, the bank qualified us for a certain amount of money, but we said to ourselves, well, what would happen if we both lost our jobs and then we had to take jobs that paid less? You know, and we're in a profession, journalism, where that's sadly possible. Well, we said, okay, well, how much house could we afford if we both lost our jobs and had to take jobs that paid half as much as we make now? And that's how much house we're going to buy. And that meant, obviously, that we'd make some compromises on things like where the location was, how good big the backyard was, and whether it had all the latest bells and whistles. It also means that we sleep so much better at night because we're never worried that we're not going to be able to pay this mortgage. We have a mortgage that we'll be able to pay basically unless both of us become permanently and totally disabled. And that also allows us to pay off the mortgage, pay extra, and hopefully get it paid off sooner. So the advantage of that is that now I can take career risks. My husband can take career risks. We can do things that we otherwise couldn't because we minimize that the what could happen if we had an economic setback. We minimize the odds that we would get thrown out of our house for the same reason we don't have any debt on our cars. After that, after you've prepared, you've understood, okay, I need to take risks in order to grow and succeed. I need to make sure that I have the capacity to take those risks by minimizing how catastrophic that risk could be. What happens after you failed? Okay, well, the first thing is you have to recognize that you failed. Again, sounds really obvious, but here's the thing. When you look at companies, when you look at people, and I talk in one chapter about both a relationship that I stayed in for 4 years, which was way past the time at which it had become obvious it wasn't working. I also talk about GM, and we did the same thing, which is that we were really, really worried about how much we'd invested in this thing that wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And we sort of panicked when we thought about losing that, and so we invested more trying to get it back. You know, that's really common behavior. So you have to be looking out for it and prepared to say, okay, this isn't working. I have to stop.
You were able to put yourself, though, in a position where you could afford failure. And many people are not in that position. You've talked about in the book that for a rich kid, they can make a mistake and they can still go to college. They can afford failure. A poor kid makes one mistake, all their college dreams are thrown out the window. And then their lifetime earning, their lifetime standard of living is extremely diminished from there on out. Same thing with a lot of people looking at the issue of bankruptcy. They're not able to get bankruptcy as they used to in order to get a fresh start. We've taken it to where people on the ladder of opportunity can completely fall off and not even grab onto a rung anymore. And that has to be stifling risk-taking.
So here is what I would say, is that yes, I think it is stifling risk-taking, and I think that the way that we've set up the system, especially with education, is making it harder and harder to re-enter if you fall off. And that's a huge problem. It's also a problem for the people who are on the ladder, because we have this sense that if you don't get that good college degree, you're doomed. And so you can't afford to take any risk. You know, one person, I gave a talk on my book tour, and a lovely 15-year-old girl came up to me and said, you know, I would really love to do this. I understand that risking failure is important, but I can't afford to take a class. I won't get a 4.0 in because then I won't get into a good college. And I thought, wow, America, you are doing it wrong, right? That should never be. This is a girl who's clearly, she's in an international baccalaureate program. She's obviously got a lot of support at home and understands how the system works, but at the same time feels like she's no margin for error whatsoever. So what are we doing? We're taking kids who have a lot of opportunity, and we're telling them that in order to get that opportunity, they have to stifle any instinct to do anything except conform and take the easiest route possible to get that credential. And that is really, I think, death to the American economy. And as you say, it's also terrible for poor kids, because those kids, you know, the increasing reliance on this college credential means they can't get on the ladder in the first place.
Do we do enough to lift people up when they fail?
In some ways, we do a lot. Our bankruptcy system, while I opposed the 2005 reform that made bankruptcy a little harder to get, I don't think on aggregate there's a lot of evidence that people just can't get bankruptcy relief even if they want it.
Although, to specifically relate it to what we were just talking about, student loan debt is not forgivable under bankruptcy.
Yes, and I think that is a disgrace and that we should change it. That said, you know, if you compare this to European countries where the sort of bankruptcy relief we offer just often isn't available to people at all. So in my book, I actually interview a Danish entrepreneur who's been trying to pay on the same debt for 10 years with no success. It's basically as big as it was when he started, because he can't take bankruptcy relief. And so it is just, you know, he's at risk of losing his house.
Let's talk about fresh starts and forgiveness and punishment as we continue our conversation with Megan McArdle. The upside of down. Why failing well is the key to success. The upside of down. Money Radio, thanks for joining us today. We're talking with Megan McArdle. She is a writer. You may have seen her work in The Atlantic, The Economist, Newsweek, various other places, Bloomberg. You're still writing for, which ones are you still writing for?
I still write for Bloomberg.
Okay. So you can look for her work in Bloomberg. And when you do, you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to read an interesting, well-written story. That's the way Megan McArdle writes. And that's what she's done in the new book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success, The Upside of Down. Really the idea of creative destruction. So how do we punish people for their failures?
Well, if you look at on the one hand, our bankruptcy system is great. On the other hand, our prison system is terrible. You know, there's evidence that when you give people harsh prison sentences, what you do is create more criminality. And that is, you know, we now have 2.2 million people in prison in the system in some way connected to the prison system. What does that do? It takes them away from their families where there's no earning power. It endangers their kids, who they often have, who aren't getting any benefit of having a parent around. It sends them into a room where they now spend all of their time with other criminals, learning how to be better criminals. It breaks relationships that might have helped them get on the straight and narrow. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have to punish people. We do, and there are some people who are really too violent, too dangerous to have anything except prison, you know, be sent to prison for a long time. But for kind of lesser crimes, there are more effective ways that actually reduce recidivism, keep people functioning in the community, employed, gaining skills, and back on the path to rehabilitation than to just send more and more people to prison. And I think that's actually the good news is that it's being recognized on both right and left that the response to crime, the crime wave that we had from the 60s to the 90s, was just to keep ratcheting up the harshness of the punishment. And then instead what we need to do is to punish more consistently, but not so catastrophically.
Consistency is a theme throughout the book.
Yes, very important. You know, we know this with our own kids. You cannot have a kid who is allowed to, say, play basketball in the house some of the time, and then some of the time you scream at them. You need to be consistent and say, no, this is the rule always, because that's how kids learn how the world works, right? It's first of all how they learn to obey the rules, but second of all, how they get what psychologists call an internal locus of control, which is a sense that I can do something and that is going to produce results in the world. You know, there's a direct link between what I do and what happens. And criminals who have had very scattered childhoods often, they're missing that. And so, you know, what would happen in the old days is that they would be on probation and they would violate 5 or 10 times and finally get sent to prison. And when they did get sent to prison, they wouldn't say, oh, well, I violated too many times and that's why this happened. They would say, well, I guess my probation officer was having a bad day. You know, they weren't connecting, oh, I can keep myself out of jail, and this is how. That's not how they're raised, and it's not the message they got. So in essence, one of the programs I study is a probation system that is reparenting probationers in order to give them that sense of, okay, if I do this, I will stay out of jail, I will be able to have employment and relationships and so forth. And they've had phenomenal results. Just by having more patient punishments but much less harsh, they have reduced recidivism in half.
Megan, in just a few seconds here that we have remaining, are we headed in the right direction towards embracing risk and failure?
You know, there's lots of things that America can do and needs to do to make us all better at embracing failure and learning from failure. But the first is just saying to ourselves, and this is something we have long been very good at, that failure is a part of life. That people who have failed are not failures. They are people who have failed. And that's a really important distinction, that failure is part of the process of success, and that making it a success requires thinking of it not as a shameful opportunity, but an opportunity to learn.
The new book is The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success, by Megan McArdle, The Upside of Down. I took a chance, read it, and was greatly rewarded. It's a real fun book and very, very interesting and, of course, well-written. Megan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.